today in Studio 360.
Worrying can't get you anywhere.
Has any children's entertainment shaped the modern American sensibility more than Mad Magazine?
Excuse me, is this Mad Magazine?
No, it's Mademoiselle. We're buying our sign on the installment plan.
There wouldn't have been National Lampoon without Mad. There wouldn't have been Spy Magazine without Mad. There wouldn't have been The Simpsons without Mad. There wouldn't have been Saturday Night Live without Mad.
From our series on American icons, Mad Magazine, and the invention of comedy as we know it. And speaking of spies versus spies, a TV show about real-life espionage created by a former CIA officer.
It just became part of me, and I lied all the time. Every day I was lying constantly.
I'm Kurt Anderson. That and much more is ahead in Studio 360. But to start things off, let's talk about 2015. For me, it's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, I've got to finish a book in 2015, but it's the new year, a fresh start, a blank slate, nothing but potential. So since I've got my creative New Year's resolution, write, rewrite, repeat, why don't you join me? As we've done for the last 2 years, I want you to make a New Year's resolution to pull off some creative project, science fiction short stories to write, a piano sonata to learn, a mockumentary about your cats to shoot, anything. We'll pick a few of you to follow all year long.
And my creative New Year's resolution was to stop being a sound designer and go back to playing music. Originally,
at the beginning of 2014, Gabriel Walker resolved to move to a new city, form a band, and play a show. And he did it, all of it.
One thing I really do want to do is thank
Declare your creative New Year's resolution, and we'll pick a few of you to follow all year long. You can drop us a line at studio360.org or call us at 646-580-0360. That's 646-580-0360. The deadline for us to get your creative New Year's resolution is Monday, January 5th. So resolve right now to make your resolution this coming week.
Last night versus LA.
Did they win?
No, it was a tie.
I'm not going in today, so you're going to have to handle.
Philip and Elizabeth Jennings are an attractive suburban couple in the 1980s. Pure yuppies right around the time the word yuppie was coined. They've got two kids. They run a travel agency together. They live in a nice house, absolutely standard issue, all-American, upscale people, except that Philip and Elizabeth are actually Russians, KGB spies for the Soviet Union. They are characters in a very good show called The Americans, which is just about to start its third season. And it was created by a former American spy named Joe Weisbert. I talked to him last winter. Joe, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt. Great to be here.
So, when you worked at the CIA, I was a friend of your brother's and didn't know he had this interesting brother, and I employed him. He is a famous liberal. Your parents are famous liberals. So was becoming a CIA agent an act of rebellion?
That's funny. If you ask my brother, that's the story he tells. And I don't think I can really say it's not true. I don't know that I was conscious of it. I wasn't thinking I'm going to rebel, but I'm sure something like that was going on beneath the surface. You know, in my head, what was going on was I took a course in college called History of the Soviet Union, taught by a guy named Wolfgang Leonard, who had been an East German. And it really influenced me, and I started becoming more and more of an anti-communist and more of a Reaganite and wanting to fight the Soviet Union. And I think that started tying into the past where I had read a lot of John le Carré novels and wanted to be a spy, and it all sort of came together. And
so you recruited people here, right?
No, I went through the training program, which is a very long and involved training program, and I did a lot of assignments in headquarters on different desks, and then I ended up leaving before my first assignment abroad. I never recruited anybody.
And how come? Why'd you quit?
at the time, what I sort of told myself, I had a lot of personal things going on. My father had become ill. I took a leave of absence to go take care of him when he was dying. I sort of went back after that for a summer, and I just felt that I had kind of lost my desire to go live abroad and do this job. But as I look back at it now, I think I'd really lost faith in what they did, that I had seen firsthand the kind of people they recruited and the intelligence they provided, and that it was all kind of BS, that the agents weren't worth anything and the intelligence they were providing was not valuable to the U.S. government. But what you really did do to collect that intelligence was ask all these people to really risk their lives for a lot of nothing. And I think I was kind of unconsciously aware of that and didn't want to do that job.
As a CIA operative, you had to lie a lot. And then you started writing fiction. Lots of fiction writers have talked about that fiction is a matter of lying professionally. Do you see that kinship?
It always felt completely different to me. I actually wrote fiction from the time I was a kid. I started when I was about 12 years old. I wrote my first short story, somewhat troublingly called The Midlife Crisis Exploits. I still worry about that a little bit. But I never felt like I was lying when I wrote fiction. I just felt like I was telling stories and in a lot of ways trying to get at the truth when I was telling stories. But when I joined the CIA, I had a lot of concerns about it at the beginning. I thought to myself, can I actually lie to people about what I do, about my job?
Like your friends?
Yeah, my friends. Although a couple of people in my family knew, nobody in my extended family knew. And can I lie to them? And will I be able to do this? And then I joined and I started. And it took about a month. And then I was just completely used to it. I never had any doubts about it again. It just became part of me. And I lied all the time. Every day I was lying constantly. It just became really second nature.
Beyond what you needed to do because it got so easy?
I wouldn't say I went overboard, but I would say as opposed to some of my friends in the CIA who were sort of more insular and only hung out with other people at the CIA, I was put in a position where I had to lie more.
Interesting. So 4 summers ago, a whole bunch of Russian secret agents living in American suburbs are busted. How long was it before you thought, that's a TV show I can do?
I didn't think it and never would have thought it. What happened was probably even just a few weeks after that incident, my phone rang. And it was two guys named Daryl Frank and Justin Falvey, who were the heads of DreamWorks Television. And they said, I was working on a show then called Falling Skies, a science fiction show that they produce. And they said, Joe, what do you think about developing a television show based on this? The honest to God truth is I thought in my head, I don't think that's such a good idea. But, you know, when the heads of DreamWorks Television call and ask if you want to develop a TV
suddenly,
show,
maybe it's a good idea.
That comes out of your mouth. What is in your head doesn't matter. What comes out is that's a great idea. And I started wandering around the streets and thinking about how to turn it into something. And I don't know why it took 2 weeks, but after about 2 weeks, I thought, oh, well, you got to put in the Cold War.
In addition to being a thriller and a spy story, it's also about this strange marriage where the couple doesn't really know if it's a real marriage or not, or what version of fake or real it's supposed to be. I want to play a clip. This is where Elizabeth confesses to her husband, Philip, that she's had an affair with an asset of theirs named Gregory, a former Black Panther.
When we got here, I was 22 years old. I was living in a strange house in a strange country with a strange man. And I met Gregory, and he was passionate about the cause. He was passionate about everything. He was passionate about me. And he didn't even want anything. He just believed like I did. He was the first person I felt I could really talk to. And I needed that. It just happened. It never really happened that way for us, did it?
No.
That was Matthew Reese and Kerry Russell in a scene from the first season of The Americans. Joe, did you start with a clear sense of how real the characters' arranged professional marriage was supposed to feel to them? Or do you go back and forth as you write more episodes and then get deeper into it and discover more?
We have a clear sense that the marriage is the centerpiece of the show. And during the 15 years of backstory of this marriage, that a marriage had been arranged by the KGB, and that from the moment they met, which we showed in the pilot, Philip had been really in love with Elizabeth, and that she had not really shared that feeling for him, and that throughout the first season, they are trying to have a real marriage for the first time because her feelings have changed.
And meanwhile, both of them are using sex with assets and potential assets as part of their jobs, which, of course, complicates the real marriage they're trying to forge.
Yes, of course. And their ability to compartment that or not is one of the interesting things in the series. And also, one of the things in the show that is based on historical fact that seems like it might be a TV thing, but really the KGB encouraged their officers to use sex to gain intelligence information. And perhaps most startlingly of all, you know, this is a spoiler for anybody who hasn't seen the show. You might want to start humming for just a second. But Philip eventually marries his asset, Marcia.
Who is a secretary to an FBI official.
Exactly. And KGB illegals actually
really?
Did that. They actually married women. It was called usually secretaries to important men who the KGB wanted information from. So the KGB illegal would marry the secretary without the secretary having any idea the person was a KGB illegal. These marriages lasted for years, and the men would get intelligence from the secretary.
I'm glad you told me that because I really did think, no.
Yeah. I wish we could have made that up.
Huh. So many spy shows and movies these days are all about technology and these computer devices and GPS and cell phones even. Is not having to deal with that make it easier for you to plot or harder or both?
It's much better for our storytelling for a couple of reasons. One is that there are no cell phones, so they can't solve a problem by picking up the phone. Philip can't pick up the phone, call Elizabeth and say, get out of there. And if you watch TV shows, there's a cell phone. I mean, in every crime or spy story, there's a cell phone in everything. It solves everything. It creates problems. It solves problems. We don't have that. So in a way, it's good. It makes the stories more complex and richer. But I also think that the espionage tradecraft of the early 80s, and this tradecraft is still in use. It's not like it doesn't exist anymore.
How they follow and how they lose people
exactly.
Who are following them and all that.
Surveillance, yeah. The counter-surveillance, the dead drops, the brush passes, all this kind of classic espionage tradecraft is just more interesting. And again, they still use it now, but also now they have computers and you can send things through encrypted email and things like that solve a lot of these problems or alternate ways of doing things. You couldn't do it back then. And that's the tradecraft I studied. And it's just more fun. It's more visual. There's nothing that visual or interesting about, sending an encrypted email.
Francis Rations, Visiotech Security.
Come in.
Can you check my credential fully, please, sir?
Of course.
A few weeks ago, the Department of Defense mandated a top-to-bottom security review of all private company contractors in the ballistic missile defense program. I'm going to need to ask you a few questions, sir.
Now, any script you write, as opposed to other people who write scripts for the show, needs to be read and approved by the CIA. Is that a pain in the ass? Has it been a pain in the ass?
Earlier in my career, when I was writing certain things, I did have some trouble with this process. I, for example, one time wrote a treatment for a show and sent it in to the Publications Review Board, which is a part of the CIA that handles this. And they just wrote back, you can't do that. So now, in the end, I was able to sort of make some changes and massage it and work it out with them. But over the years, I started to figure out what types of things they have problems with and what types of things they don't. So the process has been very, very smooth on the Americans.
What kinds of things would they say no to?
I don't write anything about cover because I know from experience that details about – or about CIA cover, details about how cover is
– Meaning the fake jobs that people have.
Exactly. Details about that – They won't let anything by. I never mention it. I can mention it like this, but I wouldn't go into any detail with you or talk about that at all because that's one of their real sore spots.
You're starting your new season after the Winter Olympics in Russia. Is that going to be good for you as people are thinking about Russia and thinking about this newly belligerent, Putin-esque, kind of pseudo-Soviet Russia?
The moment it struck me that I realized that was all coinciding, I thought it was pretty great. And we're going to have some commercials on during the Olympics. And I thought, oh, it's all coming together nicely.
It's all – Putin is helping you. It's all part of a cross-promotional marketing plan.
I wonder all the time what Putin would think of the show. I can't figure out the answer to that.
Well, I look forward to this new season and keep making good shows.
Thanks so much, Kirk.
Joe Weisberg is co-creator of The Americans. I talked to him last winter. The third season of the show starts on January 28th on FX. My DVR is set. Coming up now, if you ever wondered why, starting around half a century ago, kids got so snarky and sarcastic, we've got the culprit.
Mad won. Mad is now the dominant culture. Snark is normal now.
The long, weird shadow of Mad Magazine is just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and this is Studio 360. We like to offer you guys projects that get you to flex your creative muscles. We call them extra credit challenges.
I love the creative challenge.
We've got a new one now that I think you'll love, or at least really like, enough for, you know, an intense short-term relationship.
I am fond of you, you know.
A little bit of love.
We want you to make a movie, a romantic comedy that is no more than 30 seconds long. It could be the meet cute, the catastrophic first date, discovering she sleeps with stuffed animals, or the wacky multi-religious wedding. Whatever story you can tell in 30 seconds. And the judge of our contest is the director Kevin Smith, whose movies include Chasing Amy, Zach and Miri Make a Porno, and Clerks. He'll be on the show to talk about your submissions and pick the winner. The deadline for sending us your super short is February 1st. All the details are at studio360.org/romcom.
You complete me.
Who said you could go in my office?
We're exploring. But all we found was a large collection of Mad magazines.
It's a gag!
When I was a little kid growing up in Nebraska back in the 1960s, there was not much in the way of fresh, funny subversiveness for children to consume. Yeah, Bugs Bunny and Looney Tunes on TV, but those were already decades old. And current magazines for kids like Highlights or Boy's Life seemed like relics from our parents' childhoods. Then there was Mad Magazine. People say Dr. Spock gave us a whole generation of spoiled kids, but Mad turned them into smart alecks on a scale the world had never seen. As part of our continuing series of American icons, we asked Trey Kay to tell us how this odd little New York magazine became such an important institution.
In the 1950s, serious thinkers believed comic books were polluting young minds. People like Frederick Wortham, an influential psychiatrist.
The real question is this: are comic books good or are they not good? If you want to raise a generation that is half stormtroopers and half cannon fodder with a dash of illiteracy, then comic books are good. In fact, they are perfect.
Wortham called his book about comics Seduction of the Innocent. One of the best seducers was William Gaines, publisher of EC Comics. He was a comic book innovator who was churning out entertaining crime, war, and sci-fi comics, as well as horror comics like Tales from the Crypt, which were inspired by 1940s radio drama. And Gaines started kicking around the idea of making a comic book that would spoof other comic books.
And so he came up with Mad Comics.
That's Maria Riedelbach, author of Completely Mad, A History of the Comic Book and Magazine.
And from the very beginning, it was really wild. He was going places where comics had never gone before.
Mad Comics hit the stands in 1952 with stories about Super Duperman and Batman.
Not the Batman we know and love from DC Comics. This is a Batman who wants to knock up Wonder Woman and get her in the kitchen barefoot and pregnant, and there she is.
Mad Comics were doing great until the whole comic book industry was called before a United States Senate subcommittee investigating juvenile delinquency back in 1954.
And you think that does the children lots of good to read those things, do you?
I don't think it does them a bit of good, sir, but I don't think it does them a bit of harm either.
That's Bill Gaines at the hearing. But before Congress could make any laws, comic publishers offered to self-regulate by forming the Code of the Comics Association. There would be no more shooting, no kissing, no fun, basically.
He saw the writing on the wall, And what he decided to do was to try to transform his comics into something even more evolved. And what that was a sort of a magazine format, a hybrid format.
See, comic books were being censored, but magazines were not. So instead of colorful pages, Gaines published black and white illustrations on cheap paper. And there was no more artist hand lettering. Now everything would be typeset. The changes didn't work well for horror and crime comics, but they let Mad's original editor, Harvey Kurtzman, broaden his horizons.
Harvey Kurtzman started mining all of American culture at that point. When he was doing Mad Comics, he was mainly focusing on parodying other comics. But when he went into Mad Magazine, he started parodying newspapers, you know, TV shows. TV was new then. Movies, Broadway musicals, you know, anything he could get his hands on.
Mad invented the sensibility we now call snarky. Sociologist Todd Gitlin wrote about Mad in his book, The 60s, Years of Hope, Days of Rage. He said, "If consumer culture achieved some of its power by taking itself hyper-seriously, Mad pulled the plug and said, hey, the Lone Ranger, Wonder Bread, TV commercials, even Marlon Brando are ridiculous."
I had this feeling that a lot of the official proclamations, slogans, icons of the moment were fraudulent or stupid, and what was fun and exhilarating about Mad was that it agreed.
There's a funny little fella who you all know. He can cheer you up when you're feeling.
In 1956, Mad's new editor, Al Feldstein, decided they needed a mascot, something as identifiable as Playboy's bunny. He settled on a painting of a gap-toothed, wiseacre boy with the motto, "What? Me worry?
Worrying can't get you anywhere."
Alfred E. Newman, the face, was something that had been used over and over by different artists throughout the 20th and back into the 19th century until Mad really took him and really made him their centerpiece.
They put Alfred E. Newman on the cover of just about every issue. That devil-may-care grin seemed like an invitation to something naughty.
It was always something I sort of hid. I don't know why.
That's Mark Dropp, who writes for Disney TV. He says Mad had a big influence on his writing.
There was an older kid in the neighborhood who had a treehouse, and when he wasn't around to chuck rocks at us, we would sneak up there, you know, and up in his treehouse he had a stack of old Playboys, and inside that stack was the first Mad magazine I ever saw.
Kids were attracted to Mad's subversive counterculture feel, but also to the goofy, violent slapstick of Spy vs. Spy and Don Martin cartoons, and really weird, inventive things like the fold-in.
I'm Al Jaffe, and I've been doing the fold-in for 50 years.
93-year-old Jaffe came up with the fold-in while looking at the glossy, full-color fold-outs in Playboy, National Geographic, and Life.
So I looked at these things, and there was a sort of mark of pretentiousness about it. And, of course, that naturally triggers the opposite point of view if you're working for Mad.
So Jaffe made a funny drawing with a message below, and there were instructions for the reader to fold arrow A to arrow B in order to transform the picture and message. He brought the demo to editor Al Feldstein.
I said, "I think this is a funny idea, but you're not going to buy it because it mutilates the magazine." He looked at it, and he was intrigued. He grabbed it, he says, "Let me go." And he rushed into Bill Gaines and came out 2 minutes later and said, "We're going to do it." Bill said, "If they mutilate the magazine, they'll buy another one to save."
Another example of Mad's new visual comedy was The Marginal Thinking Department by artist Sergio Aragonés.
Which are these tiny, scratchy little drawings just embedded in the margins and little gutters of the magazine.
Mad fan George Babiak would pore over each issue with a fine-toothed comb.
Each little cartoon was microscopic. It was like taking the magazine down to its molecular level and finding the jokes that made up the whole magazine, the little atomic-sized jokes.
That's an interesting thing about Mad. It was funny, but it was kind of an education. They talk about stupid TV shows and then global politics. In 1963, they did a Cold War parody called When You're a Red.
When you're a red, all the way from your first party purge to your last power play.
It featured drawings of Nikita Khrushchev dancing around with a street gang. That's George Babiak singing.
You set off a test, and when you're halfway through it, you point to the west and say they drove you to it. That's how you do it. When you're a red and some land you invade, always say your attack's just a new kind of hate. Then they'll be red, or else they're dead.
I'm Arnie Kogan. I'm a comedy writer. I've been writing for Mad Magazine since 1959.
Kogan also wrote gags for Jackie Gleason, Johnny Carson, and Carol Burnett. He still writes a lot of Mad's movie parodies.
I never aimed anything at kids. I just wrote what I thought was funny, and if kids got it, they got it. If they didn't get it, that was their problem. Or they would learn to get it, or they'd look it up.
It was like a secret window into the adult world. I mean, how many 12-year-olds had seen Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
In fact, he was sort of a flop. A great, big, fat flop.
Stop it, Martha.
I hope that was an empty bottle, George. You can't afford to waste good liquor. Not on your salary. Not on an associate professor's salary.
Here's the Mad version.
Well, here we are. Me, the dirty, rotten daughter of a university president, and you, a dirty, rotten history teacher. It's 2 o'clock in the morning, and we've just returned from our faculty party to our dirty, rotten home.
If you recognize the voice, that's Brooke Gladstone from On the Media with her co-host, Bob Garfield.
Right. And now we're going to play dirty, rotten games for the rest of the night. Because through these games, the author plans to dramatically strip away our facades and reveal the fulsome phantasmagoria of base rot that permeates our souls.
That sounds deep. What in hell does it mean?
It means that this is an art film, so now the censors will have to let us talk dirty.
I knew there were strange things going on in my own dysfunctional family that I really didn't understand and that were really disturbing and weird.
That's Maria Reidelbach, the Mad historian.
And when I read the parody of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, I could see that, even though it was like this warped funhouse mirror version of Edward Albee's funhouse mirror version of this couple, it spoke to me.
The late Roger Ebert said stuff like that taught him how to be a film critic. He wrote, "Mad's parodies made me aware of the machine inside the skin, of the way a movie might look original on the outside, while inside, it was just recycling the same old dumb formulas." And even now, the jokes don't talk down to kids.
I think it's really funny. The things in here, they're just so, they're classic stupid humor. It's hilarious.
11-year-old Liam Schmidt's dad just gave him his first issue of Mad.
And I open it, I start reading it. Oh, this is really funny. The real reasons Vladimir Putin hates America. And I read all of them, and then I saw this one, and it's so funny. He can see Sarah Palin from his house because it's just...
There's a drawing of a goofy-looking Palin standing outside Putin's window.
She's like, "Hello!" It's really funny. It's just hilarious.
9-year-old Elizabeth Aldous didn't get the Palin joke, but she definitely got the parody of Pharrell Williams' Happy. The Mad version is Appy.
Because I'm Appy, I'm on Facebook, Twitter, Skype. I'm even on my space.
It's about some poor soul addicted to his smartphone.
Because I'm Appy, living in an alleyway, sleeping on a pile of trash. Because I'm Appy, got my phone turned back on by selling my blood for cash. Because I'm Appy...
A couple of generations of adults have now been reared on Mad. If you go to the writer's room of a show like The Simpsons, all Mad fans. Al Jean is that show's executive producer.
Well, there's things that we do that are just like Mad, you know, movie parodies, song parodies, the, you know, sort of wise guy sensibility. I mean, I think too, you know, like Mad, we try to reach for an audience where kids are a given, but we go for adults.
He says that like Mad packed every inch of the page with jokes, a Simpsons episode was packed so full, fans needed to freeze the frames.
Pause, we knew people had VCRs that they could pause, and we would put things in that you could never catch on a first viewing at regular speed, but you could pause and read if you wanted to, and rewarded people for doing it.
Mad Magazine! Oh.
The writers paid homage in this episode when Bart is visiting New York.
Excuse me, is this Mad Magazine?
No, it's Mademoiselle. We're buying our sign on the installment plan.
Seriously, though, my name is Bart Simpson. My father has a subscription. I'd like the grand tour, please.
Listen, kid, you probably think lots of crazy stuff goes on in there, but this is just a place of business.
Oh, okay.
A dejected Bart turns to leave. Suddenly, a door opens, and Mad's mascot, Alfred E. Newman, pokes his head out.
Give me Kaputnik and Phone Bone. I want to see the drawings for the new kids on the block.
Behind Alfred, the inner sanctum is a fantasy funhouse. People bouncing around on pogo sticks, zeppelins flying through the air, the spy versus spy guys detonating bombs. Bart's jaw drops.
Wow. I will never wash these eyes again.
Well, I think as a kid, you would imagine if you went to Mad Magazine, it would be like the equivalent of a comedy Disneyland.
But if you actually went there as a kid?
My name is Jake Hogan. I'm a comedy writer for movies and television, and I've been getting laid because my dad writes for Mad since I was in fifth grade.
Jay was one of the original writers for The Simpsons. His dad is Arnie Hogan, who writes Mad movie parodies.
And I used to tell my story of going to Mad Magazine with my dad to The Simpsons writers, and it was like the most boring, unhappy place. Quiet secretaries, typing, waiting for lunch. Could have been any accounting firm. And it was
It was not quite as much fun as an accounting firm.
Deloitte and Touche has better parties.
But whether or not the office is an exciting place to hang out, Mad's current editor, John Ficarra, believes there's no denying the impact that the magazine has had on the comedy world.
There wouldn't have been National Lampoon without Mad. There wouldn't have been Spy Magazine without Mad. There wouldn't have been The Simpsons without Mad. There wouldn't have been Saturday Night Live without Mad.
And the Airplane movies, and David Letterman, who was a finalist in their Alfred E. Newman lookalike contest, South Park, The Daily Show, The Colbert Report, and even one not so humorous, but very popular TV drama.
Good morning. Sterling Cooper Draper Price, how may I help you?
Matthew Weiner, creator of Mad Men, says Mad's complete contempt for advertising was part of his inspiration for the TV show. The magazine gave him his first picture of, quote, this drunken, callow, glib, self-serving ad man.
The ad man must catch the 802.
This is Mad's Madison Avenue Primer, read by former editor Nick Meglin.
All ad men must catch the 802. It's a fast commuter train. It has never been more than 2 hours late, but it has a club bar. All aboard, says the conductor. Chug, chug, says the train. Gulp, gulp, says the ad man. Would you like bourbon for breakfast, too?
When Matthew Weiner came to write Mad Men, with its boozy, smoky, sexist, racist characters, he had a message about that era. But Nick Meglin says Mad never had an agenda.
We've always considered ourselves just a funhouse mirror reflection on the society at the time. We kicked whatever politician was in office at the time, not a particular party. We just, you know, if you want to be president, fine. You're going to take whatever fun that we can throw at you. And, you know, you make yourself the target, and we have the bow and arrows of humor.
In 1955, when Mad began, it was just one bow, shooting arrows at powerful, huge targets. It reached its high water mark of 2 million in sales in 1974 when it reflected the nation's cynicism over Vietnam and Watergate. But now, there's a 24/7 comedy media that reveres nothing, fires constantly, and never runs out of arrows.
Mad won. I mean, Mad is now the dominant culture. The culture is now a culture of snark. Snark is normal now.
Sociologist Todd Gitlin of Columbia University.
Today, in general, being unserious is the premium posture. I think we have a culture of disposable humor and not a culture that stops anybody in their tracks and says, this is all bloody awful. Gags are what we do here. Taking something too seriously
is considered not getting it, and the worst thing in the world is not to get it.
And even a comedy writer like Jay Kogan sometimes wonders, is there a downside to Mad's takeover of American culture?
It supports the idea that it's better to be cynical and examine something than really feel something. And over time, I've felt that I've been much more ready to pick something apart and to make fun of it rather than to just enjoy it for the truth or the fun that it is. I don't think until I actually had a child was I able to really appreciate that there is such a thing as innocent joy. And innocent joy is a pretty good thing. And that's not the kind of thing that we're, you know, extolling in Mad Magazine or almost anywhere else on the spectrum of comedy. There's something to be said for sincerity.
For Studio 360, I'm Trey Kay.
We've got some classic pieces from Mad's archive up on our website, including the Cold War parody, East Side Story, and the cover of their first issue. While you're at our site, if you've got memories of reading Mad, being shaped by it, we'd love to have you share them in our comments section. Coming up now, forget the samba and the bossa nova. The hot new music coming out of Brazil sounds more like a lullaby.
Desde que o vento passou, rasgou meu pranto, teu casaco.
Dom La Nena is ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and this is Studio 360. Dominique Pinto makes music under the name Dom La Nena, which translates as Dom the Girl. That's not some kind of irony. Dom is pretty young, she's literally little, and she makes this dreamy, delicate pop music. This is the new single from her upcoming album, Soyo. She's singing in Spanish, but she also sings in her native Portuguese and even in French. All those cultures were part of her upbringing, as I found out when I spoke with her last year. It was just after she made her solo debut with the album called Ella.
I moved to France when I was 8 years old, and it was like a very big change in my life, and I was very small. And then when I came back to Brazil, it was another one. And when I went to Argentina, it was bigger because I went when I was 13 years old, and my parents stay in Brazil. For me, it's like I had like mini lives, you know. So, and I'm always missing someone and missing somewhere. Right. I think it's something that it's really present on the album.
I'm so fascinated by this one part of your biography, the you deciding apparently at age 13 to go to Argentina by yourself.
Yeah. Because when I was in Paris, I really fell in love with the cello and all the cello repertory, and I really wanted to be cellist. So I worked very hard on it. And when I came back to Brazil, we are from a city where there is not really good school music schools. And at this moment, I was really sad. And so we found a solution, and I was really decided that I wanted to do it. And so I moved to Buenos Aires to study, and it was such a big responsibility, but it went really well.
So how and when and why did you get the idea of, wait, I can do pop music and play the cello? Because there's not many models for people having done that.
Yeah, well, when I moved again to Paris when I was 18 years old, I was studying on the music school, and then I met a French musical producer. So we became friends, and she said, well, I need a cello. Come on, let's try it. And I was very nervous because I only played classical music. So it was the first time I was without score and without a teacher telling me what to do. And it was great. It was really fun. And I realized that I can make like a quartet by myself with with the record.
Well, you start us off with maybe the first song on your album, which is called Angel Gabriel.
Okay.
That was the singer-songwriter cellist Dom La Nena performing Angel Gabriel from her album Ella. So that, of course, sounded at various moments like several cellists playing. It was just you recording yourself and looping it with a foot pedal.
Yeah.
Was that something you was new to you and you discovered it and thought, this is awesome? How did that...
Yeah, you can do like many arrangements alone. So... When I discovered the loop pedal, it was like my dream to do like a little orchestra alone.
Well, you clearly you like being alone. Maybe that connects somehow to your love of melancholy.
Yeah,
too. But
I'm
you could
solitary.
You could have a group, but you have it's you. How about? I mean, you'd played cello for years. How about singing and playing cello?
Yeah, that was another challenge.
I bet.
Because when I started to write the songs, I never had really sing in my life. So if you listen to the demos, it's really strange because I was like discovering my voice and it was like the first time that I listened to my voice. So I started to take singing lessons. And I think even now my voice have changed since the recording.
And did you know right away, you'd never sung before, wow, my voice is great? Or did people tell you, Dom, your voice is great? How did you get the confidence to say, I'm a singer?
Yeah, no, I don't think that my voice is great. But it was, you know, I wrote the songs and I said, okay, now I need to sing it. I had no choice.
Will you play one more song, the title track?
Yeah.
Called Ella.
Yes.
Excellent.
Lembrar, não quer nem mencionar no que ficou pra trás. Ela não quer olhar, não pode suportar de saber que é assim. Todo um dia tem fim e ela nunca foi feliz. Sua vida é feita de ares bons, ares ruins, noites estreladas, noites de luar. Nunca o mesmo dia. Pra onde é que foi que o vento levou o seu olhar? Ela não quer nem tenta abrir os olhos e ver ao longe o mar. Não consegue escutar, não consegue cantar, não consegue chorar. Sua vida é feita de ares bons, ares ruins. Quando na janela, logo ao despertar, fica sufocada e não pode pular. Sua vida é feita de ares bons, ares ruins, noites estreladas, noites de luar. Nunca o mesmo dia, nunca o mesmo.
That was Dom La Nena playing Ella, which is the title track of her debut album. So you have all these languages. You've lived all these places. Do any of them feel like home? Where does feel like home?
Well, now my home is in Paris, and it's the city where I live the most part of my life. So I should say that it's Paris, but I missed a lot Brazil, and it's my family home. So I'm like between Brazil and France, maybe on the ocean.
So you were sort of raised, you were created to be feel like an exile, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, when you're a musician, you are always traveling, and I think you became yourself your home, because you're never at home, actually.
I read in a recent interview you gave that you never sent your music to your great cello teacher, Christine Walewska.
No, I'm too shy.
Well, but and you said in the same interview that you were going to hand her a CD when you're in New York.
I know.
Have you done it yet?
No.
Why?
I'm shy.
Because you think she'll think what?
I don't know.
That you've abandoned the classical music?
No, I love her so much, and I really wish that she liked the album and my music, but I am too scary about this. I don't know.
Well, maybe we can call her and she can listen to this when it's on the radio.
Well.
That scares you, huh?
Yes. But if you do it, Christine, I love you, and I really wish that you liked my music.
Dominique Pinto, thank you very, very much.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here.
K Can you, on the spur of the moment, maybe perform a kind of instrumental to be our theme song as we end the show today?
Okay.
Great. Dom La Nena's new album, Soyo, comes out in the spring, but you can hear the first single right now at studio360.org. While you're at our site, you can also find out about our new extra credit challenge to make a 30-second romantic comedy. Those details are at studio360.org/romcom. And if you've got some non-30-second filmmaking creative goal you want to achieve in 2015, we want to help you do that. Take a minute and tell us your creative New Year's resolution by leaving a comment at studio360.org or calling 646-580-0360. That's 646-580-0360. The deadline for declaring your 2015 creative New Year's resolution is Monday, January 5th. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Krista Ripple,
Zoe Azule,
Scott Ross.
Thanks this week to Carl Reel and George Bobiak for their performance in our story about MAD. And thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, Mike Lee made his reputation with edgy, super-realistic movies about how we live now. But nobody today makes a better movie about historical characters.
You're too preoccupied for your own good, sir.
Nothing comes from nothing, madam.
And we have had nothing from you, sir.
Mike Lee and Mr. Turner, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.